combination of exploration and subsequent diversity of adaptation. Thinking might, in many cases, be regarded as the abstracted form of exploration, as the capacity to investigate without the necessity of direct motoric action. Abstract analysis, verbal and nonverbal, of the unexpected or novel plays a much greater role for humans than for animals, a role that generally takes primacy over action. It is only when this capacity fails partially or completely in humans, or when it plays a paradoxical role, amplifying the significance or potential danger of the unknown through definitive but false negative labeling, that active exploration or active avoidance, with its limitations and dangers, becomes necessary. Replacement of potentially dangerous exploratory action with increasingly flexible and abstracted thought means the possibility for growth of knowledge without direct exposure to danger, and constitutes one major advantage of the development of intelligence. The abstract intelligence characteristic of the human being developed in parallel with rapid evolution of the brain. We can communicate the results and interpretations of our manipulations, and the nature of the procedures that constitute that manipulation, to each other across immense spatial and temporal barriers. This capacity for exploration, verbal elaboration, and communication of such, in turn, dramatically heightens our capacity for exploration, as we have access to all communicated strategies and interpretive schemas accumulated over time, generated in the course of the creative activity of others. In normal parlance, this would mean merely that we have been able to discover more aspects of the world. It seems to me more accurate, however, to recognize the limitations of this perspective and to make room for the realization that new procedures and modes of interpretation literally produce new phenomena. The word enables differentiated thought and dramatically heightens the capacity for exploratory maneuvering. The world of human experience is constantly transformed and renewed as a consequence of such exploration. In this manner, the word constantly engenders new creation. The capacity to create novel behaviors and categories of interpretation in response to the emergence of the unknown might be regarded as the primary hallmark of human consciousness, indeed, of human being. Our engagement in this process literally allows us to carve the world out of the undifferentiated mass of unobserved and unencountered existence, a form of existence that exists only hypothetically as a necessary fiction, a form about which nothing can be experienced unless accurately stated. We carve out the world as a consequence of our direct interactions with the unknown, most notably with our hands, which enable us to manipulate things, to change their sensory aspects, and, most importantly, to change their importance to us, to give them new, more desirable value. The capacity for dexterous manipulation is particularly human and has enabled us to radically alter the nature of our experience. Equally particular, however, is our capacity for abstract exploration, which is thought about action and its consequences, in the absence of action and its consequences. The manner in which we conduct our abstracted exploration appears as tightly linked to the physiological structures of our brains as the manner in which we move while exploring. In novel circumstances, our behavioral output is mediated by the systems that govern fear and appropriate inhibition and hope and appropriate activation. The same things happen when we think abstractly, even when we think about how others think. Animal exploration is primarily motor in nature. An animal must move around an unfamiliar thing or situation to determine its affective relevance and sensory nature. This process of moving around experimentally appears as a consequence of the interaction between the mutually regulatory or inhibitory evaluative systems whose responsibilities are identification of potential danger or threat and potential satisfaction or promise. In the human case, each of these systems apparently comes, in the course of normal development, to dominate one of our twinned cortical hemispheres. The right governs response to threat and to punishment, while the left controls response to promise and, perhaps, although much less clearly, to satisfaction. This basically means that the right hemisphere governs our initial responses to the unknown, while the left is more suited for actions undertaken while we know what we are doing. This is in part because everything thoroughly explored has in fact been rendered either promising or satisfying, or at least irrelevant. If threat or punishment still lurks somewhere, that is, somewhere we must be, our behavioral adaptation is, by definition, insufficient, and the unexpected has not been vanquished. We have been unable to modify our actions to elicit from the environment, really, from the unknown, those consequences we wish to produce. Richard Davidson and his colleagues have been investigating the relationship between different patterns of cortical electrical activity and mood states in adults and children. Davidson et al. Have concluded that the twin hemispheres of the human brain are differentially specialized for affect, at least with regard to their frontal regions. Signs of positive affect, like genuine smiling in infants, are accompanied by heightened comparative activation of the left frontal cortex. Negative states of affect, like those occurring in chronic depression, by contrast, are accompanied by heightened activation of the right frontal hemisphere. Substantial additional evidence exists to support this general claim. To put it most fundamentally, it appears that the twin hemispheres of the brain are differentially specialized. One, for operation in unexplored territory, where the nature and valence of things remains indeterminate, and two, for operation in explored territory, where things have been rendered either irrelevant or positive as a consequence of previous exploration. Our brains contain two emotional systems, so to speak. One functions when we do not know what to do, and initiates the exploratory process that creates secure territory. The other functions when we are in fact secure. The fact of the presence of these two subsystems, but not their locale, has been known for a good while. Norman Meyer and T.C. Schnirla hypothesized many decades ago that mechanisms of withdrawal and approach, characteristic of animals at virtually all levels of the evolutionary scale, provided the foundation for motivation as such. The nature of these two systems can best be understood by relating emotional state to motor activity, as we have done previously. Each hemisphere, right and left, appears to have what might be described as a family of related functions, portrayed in Figure 11, the twin cerebral hemispheres and their functions. The right hemisphere, less language fluent than its generally more dominant twin, appears specialized for the inhibition and extinction of behavior, and, therefore, for the production of negative emotion, for generation and manipulation of complex visual and auditory images, for coordination of gross motor actions, and for rapid and global recognition of patterns. The right hemisphere appears to come online when a particular situation is rife with uncertainty, appears particularly good at governing behavior when what is and what to do have not yet been clearly specified. It might be posited, in consequence, that this hemisphere is still under limbic control, since the limbic system is responsible for detecting novelty and initiating exploratory behavior. This archaic control mechanism would then drive the processes of imagistic hypothesis generation that constitute the processes of abstract exploration, fantasy, we use to give determinate and oft bizarre form to the unknown. The left hemisphere, by contrast, appears particularly skilled at linguistic processing and communication, at detailed linear thinking, at fine motor skill, and at the comprehension of wholes, in terms of their constituent elements. The left hemisphere, particularly its frontal or motor subunit, also governs approach behavior in the presence of cues of satisfaction, is integrally involved in the production of positive affect, and appears particularly good at carrying out practiced activities, applying familiar modes of apprehension. The left seems at its best when what is and what should be done are no longer questions, when tradition governs behavior and the nature and meaning of things has been relatively fixed. The dual specialization of the left, for what is being practiced and for what is positive, can be understood in part in the following manner. Positive affect rules in known territory, by definition. A thing or situation has been explored most optimally, and is therefore most well known, if it has been transformed by behavioral adaptations manifested in its presence into something of determinate use or satisfaction, or into potential for such, into promise. The right hemisphere, in contrast to the left, appears to have remained in direct contact with and to be specialized for encounter with the unknown and its terrors, which are apperceived in the domain of instinct, motivation, and affect long before they can be classified or comprehended intellectually. The right hemisphere's capacity for inhibition and extinction of behavior, for inducing caution during exploration, for governing flight, for producing negative affect, ensures that due respect is granted the inexplicable and therefore dangerous when it makes its appearance. The right's aptitude for global pattern recognition, which appears as a consequence of its basic neurophysiological structure, helps ensure that a provisional notion, a fantastic representation of the unknown event, what it is like, how action should be conducted in its presence, what other things or situations it brings to mind, might be rapidly formulated. The right hemisphere appears integrally involved in the initial stages of analysis of the unexpected or novel, and its a priori hypothesis is always this. This unknown place, this unfamiliar space, this unexplored territory is dangerous, and therefore partakes in the properties of all other known dangerous places and territories, and all those that remain unknown as well. This form of information processing, A is B, is metaphor. Generation of metaphor, key to the construction of narratives, dreams, dramas, stories, and myth, might well be regarded as the first stage of hypothesis construction. As situation-specific adaptive behaviors are generated as a consequence of exploration, this provisional labeling or hypothesis, or fantasy, might well undergo modification, assuming nothing actually punishing or determinately threatening occurs. Such modification constitutes further and more detailed learning. Anxiety recedes in the absence of punishment or further threat, including novelty. Hope occupies the affective forefront, accompanied by the desire to move forward and to explore, under the governance of the left hemisphere. The right hemisphere appears capable of dealing with less determinate information. It can use forms of cognition that are more diffuse, more global, and more encompassing, to come to terms initially with what cannot yet be understood, but undeniably exists. The right hemisphere uses its capacity for massive generalization and comprehension of imagery to place the novel stimulus in an initially meaningful context, which is the a priori manner of appropriate categorization. This context is defined by the motivational significance of the novel thing, which is revealed first by the mere fact of novelty, which makes it both threatening and promising, and then in the course of its detailed exploration. The right hemisphere remains concerned with the question, what is this new thing like? Meaning, what should be done in the presence of this unexpected occurrence, and does not care what is this thing objectively. What is the new thing like means, Is it dangerous or threatening, first and foremost, satisfying or promising? Categorization, according to Valence, means that the thing is what it signifies for behavior. The chaos that constitutes the unknown is rendered predictable, is turned into the world, by the generation of adaptive behaviors and modes of representation. It is the process of novelty-driven exploration that, in the individual case, produces such behaviors and strategies of classification. However, we are not only individuals. We exist in a very complex social environment, characterized by the constant exchange of information regarding the means and ends of proper adaptation. The human capacity for the generation of self-regulatory behavior and representation has been expanded immensely, in some ways beyond our own comprehension, by our capacity for verbal and nonverbal communication. We can learn through discussion and by reading, can absorb information directly, even from our departed but literate ancestors. But there is more. We can learn from everyone who acts in the natural course of things, or dramatically, and we can store the behaviors of individuals we come into contact with, directly by copying them, or indirectly through the intermediation of narrative and dramatic art forms. It is, of course, our ability to copy, to mimic, that underlies our capacity to do things we do not necessarily understand, that is, cannot describe explicitly. It is for that reason, in part, that we need a psychology. Patterns of behavioral and representational adaptation are generated in the course of active exploration and contact with the unknown. These patterns do not necessarily remain stable, however, once generated. They are modified and shaped, improved and made efficient, as a consequence of their communicative exchange. Individual A produces a new behavior. B modifies it. C modifies that. D radically changes C's modification, and so on ad infinitum. The same process applies to representations, metaphors, say, or explicit concepts. This means that our exploratory, assimilative, and accommodative processes actually extend over vast periods of time and space. Some of this extension, perhaps the most obvious part, is mediated by literacy. An equally complex and subtle element, however, is mediated by mimesis. Patterns of behavioral adaptation and schemas of classification or representation can be derived from the observation of others, and for that matter, from the observation of oneself. How we act in the presence of things in their constantly shifting and generally social context is what those things mean, or even what they are, before what they mean or what they are can be more abstractly or objectively categorized. What a thing is, therefore, might be determined, in the absence of more useful information, by examination of how action is conducted in its presence, which is to say that if someone runs from something, it is safe to presume that the thing is dangerous. The action, in fact, defines that presumption. The observation of action patterns undertaken by the members of any given social community, including those of the observing subject, therefore necessarily allows for the derivation and classification of provisional value schema. If you watch someone, even yourself, approach something, then you can assume that the approached thing is good, at least in some determinate context, even if you don't know anything else about it. Knowing what to do, after all, is classification, before it is abstracted. Classification in terms of motivational relevance, with the sensory aspects of the phenomena serving merely as a cue to recognition of that motivational relevance. It is certainly the case that many of our skills and our automatized strategies of classification are opaque to explicit consciousness. The fact of our multiple memory systems and their qualitatively different modes of representation, described later, ensures that such is the case. This opaqueness means, essentially, that we understand more than we know. It is for this reason that psychologists continue to depend on notions of the unconscious to provide explanations for behavior. This unconsciousness, the psychoanalytic God, is our capacity for the implicit storage of information about the nature and valence of things. This information is generated in the course of active exploration and modified, often unrecognizably, by constant multi-generational interpersonal communication. We live in social groups. Most of our interactions are social in nature. We spend most of our time around others, and when we are alone, we still wish to understand, predict, and control our personal behaviors. Our maps of the understood part of the world are therefore in large part maps of patterns of actions, of behaviors established as a consequence of creative exploration and modified in the course of endless social interactions. We watch ourselves act. From this action, we draw inferences about the nature of the world, including those acts that are part of the world. We know that the right hemisphere, at least its frontal portion, is specialized for response to punishment and threat. We also know that damage to the right hemisphere impairs our ability to detect patterns and to understand the meaning of stories. Is it too much to suggest that the emotional, imagistic, and narrative capabilities of the right hemisphere play a key role in the initial stages of transforming something novel and complex, such as the behavior of others, or ourselves, and the valence of new things, into something thoroughly understood? When we encounter something new, after all, we generate fantasies, imagistic, verbal, about its potential nature. This means we attempt to determine how the unexpected thing might relate to something we have already mastered, or at least to other things that we have not yet mastered. To say, this unsolved problem appears to be like this other problem we haven't yet solved, is a step on the way to solution. To say, here is how these still essentially mysterious phenomena appear to hang together, is an intuition of the sort that precedes detailed knowledge, is the capacity to see the forest, though not yet differentiating between the types of trees. Before we truly master something novel, which means before we can effectively limit its indeterminate significance to something predictable, even irrelevant, we imagine what it might be. Our imaginative representations actually constitute our initial adaptations. Our fantasies comprise part of the structure that we use to inhibit our responses to the a priori significance of the unknown, even as such fantasies facilitate generation of more detailed and concrete information. There is no reason to presuppose that we have been able to explicitly comprehend this capacity, in part because it actually seems to serve as a necessary or axiomatic precondition for the ability to comprehend explicitly. The uniquely specialized capacities of the right hemisphere appear to allow it to derive from repeated observations of behavior images of action patterns that the verbal left can arrange with increasing logic and detail into stories. A story is a map of meaning, a strategy for emotional regulation and behavioral output, a description of how to act in a circumstance to ensure that the circumstance retains its positive motivational salience, or at least has its negative qualities reduced to the greatest possible degree. The story appears generated in its initial stages by the capacity for imagery and pattern recognition characteristic of the right hemisphere, which is integrally involved in narrative cognition and in processes that aid or are analogous to such cognition. The right hemisphere has the ability to decode the nonverbal and melodic aspects of speech, to empathize or to engage more generally in interpersonal relationships, and the capacity to comprehend imagery, metaphor, and analogy. The left hemisphere linguistic systems finish the story, adding logic, proper temporal order, internal consistency, verbal representation, and possibility for rapid, abstract, explicit communication. In this way, our explicit knowledge of value is expanded through the analysis of our own dreams. Interpretations that work, that is, that improve our capacity to regulate our own emotions, to turn the current world into the desired world, to say it differently, qualify as valid. It is in this manner that we verify the accuracy of our increasingly abstracted presumptions. The process of creative exploration, the function of the knower, so to speak, who generates explored territory, has as its apparent purpose an increase in the breadth of motoric repertoire, skill, and alteration of representational schema. Each of these two purposes appears served by the construction of a specific form of knowledge and its subsequent storage in permanent memory. The first form has been described as knowing how. The motor unit, charged with origination of new behavioral strategies when old strategies fail, when they produce undesired results, produces alternate action patterns experimentally applied to bring about the desired result. Permanent instantiation of the new behavior, undertaken if the behavior is successful, might be considered development of new skill. Knowing how is skill. The second type of knowing, which is representational, an image or model of something rather than the thing itself, has been described as knowing that. I prefer knowing what. Exploration of a novel circumstance, event, or thing produces new sensory and affective input during active or abstracted interaction of the exploring subject and the object in question. This new sensory input constitutes grounds for the construction, elaboration, and update of a permanent but modifiable four-dimensional, spatial and temporal, representational model of the experiential field in its present and potential future manifestations. This model, I would propose, is a story. It is the hippocampal system, which, as we have seen, is an integral part of the regulation of anxiety, that is critically involved in the transfer of information from observation of ongoing activity to permanent memory, and that provides the physiological basis, in concert with the higher cortical structures, for the development and elaboration of this nestic representation. It is the right hemisphere, which is activated by the unknown, and which can generate patterns rapidly, that provides the initial imagery, the contents of fantasy, for the story. It is the left hemisphere that gives these patterns structure and communicability, as it does, for example, when it interprets a painting, a novel, a drama, or a conversation. The hippocampus notes mismatch. This disinhibits the amygdala, perhaps not directly. Such disinhibition releases anxiety and curiosity, driving exploration. The right hemisphere, under these conditions of motivation, derives patterns relevant to encapsulation of the emergent unknown from the information at its disposal. Much of this information can be extracted from the social environment and the behavioral interactions and strategies of representation, emergent properties of exploration and communication, that are embedded in the social structure. Much of this information is still implicit, that is, coded in behavioral pattern. It is still knowing how before it has been abstracted and made explicit as knowing what. The left hemisphere gets increasingly involved as translation up the hierarchy of abstraction occurs. Knowing how information, described alternatively as procedural, habitual, dispositional, or skilled, and knowing what information, described alternatively as declarative, episodic, factual, autobiographical, or representational, appear physiologically distinct in their material basis and separable in course of phylo and ontogenetic development. Procedural knowledge develops long before declarative knowledge in evolution and individual development and appears represented in unconscious form, expressible purely in performance. Declarative knowledge, by contrast, knowledge of what, simultaneously constitutes consciously accessible and communicable episodic imagination, the world in fantasy, and subsumes even more recently developed semantic, linguistically mediated knowledge, whose operations in large part allow for abstract representation and communication of the contents of the imagination. Squire and Zola Morgan have represented the relationship between these memory forms according to the schematic of Figure 12, the multiple structure of memory. The neuroanatomical basis of knowing how remains relatively unspecified. Skill generation appears in part as the domain of the cortical premotor unit. Storage appears to involve the cerebellum. Knowing what, by contrast, appears dependent for its existence on the intact function of the cortical sensory unit in interplay with the hippocampal system. Much of our knowing what, however, our description of the world, is about knowing how, which is behavioral knowledge, wisdom. Much of our descriptive knowledge, representational knowledge, is representation of what constitutes wisdom, without being that wisdom itself. We have gained our description of wisdom by watching how we act in our culturally governed social interactions and by representing those actions. We know how, which means how to act to transform the mysterious and ever-threatening world of the present into what we desire, long before we know how we know how, or why we know how. This is to say, for example, that a child learns to act appropriately, assuming it does, long before it can provide abstracted explanations for or descriptions of its behavior. A child can be good without being a moral philosopher. This idea echoes the developmental psychologist Jean Piaget's notion with regard to child development that adaptation at the sensory motor level occurs prior to and lays the groundwork for the more abstracted forms of adaptation that characterize adulthood. Piaget regarded imagistic representation as an intermediary between sensory motor intelligence and the highest or most abstract stage of formal operations. Furthermore, he believed that imitation, the acting out of an object, served as a necessary prerequisite to such imagistic representation, portrayal in image or word instead of behavior. The process of play appears as a higher order or more abstract form of imitation from this perspective. Piaget presents two main theses. The first is that in the field of play and imitation, it is possible to trace the transition from sensory motor assimilation and accommodation to the mental assimilation and accommodation which characterize the beginnings of representation. The second is that the various forms of representation interact. There is representation when an absent model is imitated. There is representation in symbolic play, in imagination, and even in dreams. The systems of concepts and logical relations, both in their intuitive and operational forms, implies representation. Piaget believed that imitation could be described in terms of accommodation. Quote, "If there is primacy of accommodation, matching of behavior, over assimilation, altering of schemas, the activity tends to become imitation." End quote. This implies that the imitating child in fact embodies more information than he understands, represents. Piaget continues, "Representation can be seen to be a kind of interiorized imitation and therefore a continuation of accommodation. With regard to the three-memory system model, which Piaget is of course not directly referring to, open quote, even if there were justification for relating the various stages of mental development to well-defined neurological levels, the fact remains that, in spite of the relative discontinuity of the structures, there is a certain functional continuity, each structure preparing for its successors while utilizing its predecessors. End quote. What can be said of children appears true, more or less, phylogenetically. Our cultures, which we absorb as children through the processes of imitation, consist primarily of patterns of activity undertaken in a social context. As parents are to children, cultures are to adults. We do not know how the patterns we act out or the concepts we utilize originated, or what precise purposes, what long-term goals they currently serve. Such patterns are in fact emergent properties of long-term social interactions. Furthermore, we cannot describe such patterns well, abstractly, explicitly, semantically, even though we duplicate them accurately and unconsciously in our behavior, and can represent them episodically in our literary endeavors. We do not know why we do what we do, or, to say the same thing, what it is that we are, all ideological theories to the contrary. We watch ourselves and wonder. Our wonder takes the shape of the story, or, more fundamentally, the myth. Myths describing the known, explored territory, constitute what we know about our knowing how before we can state explicitly what it is that we know how. Myth is, in part, the image of our adaptive action as formulated by imagination before its explicit containment in abstract language. Myth is the intermediary between action and abstract linguistic representation of that action. Myth is the distilled essence of the stories we tell ourselves about the patterns of our own behavior as they play themselves out in the social and impersonal worlds of experience. We learn the story, which we do not understand, which is to say, cannot make explicit, by watching. We represent the action patterns we encounter in action, that is ritual, image and word. We act, then represent our behavior ever more abstractly, ever more explicitly, consciously. The central features of our socially determined behavior thus become key elements, characters in our stories. The generation and constant refinement of these stories, told and retold over centuries, allows us to determine ever more clearly just what proper and improper behavior consists of in an environment permanently characterized by the interplay between security and unpredictability. We are extremely, uncontrollably imitative, overwhelmingly social, and interminably exploratory. These characteristics allow us to generate and communicate represented images and, simultaneously, serve as the focal point of inquiry for those images. Our capacity for creative action frees us constantly from the ever-shifting demands of the environment. The ability to represent creative action, to duplicate observed creativity in our own actions, and to represent that creativity in detail and essence, allows everyone to benefit from the creative action of everyone else, at least everyone with whom communication might conceivably take place. The fact of our sociability ensures that our adaptive behaviors are structured with the social community in mind, at least in the long run, and increases our chances of exposure to creative intelligence. We observe others acting in a manner we find admirable, and duplicate their actions. In this manner, we obtain the skills of others. Our capacity for abstraction allows us to take our facility for imitation one step further, however. We can learn to imitate not only the precise behaviors that constitute adaptation, but the process by which those behaviors were generated. This means we can learn not only skill, but meta-skill, can learn to mimic the pattern of behavior that generates new skills. It is the encapsulation of meta skill in a story that makes that story great. Our imitative proclivity, expressed in behavior, appears to find its more abstracted counterpart in the ability to admire, which is a permanent, innate, or easily acquired constituent element of our intrapsychic state. This capability for awe, this desire to copy, often serves to impel further psychological and cognitive development. The worshipful attitude that small boys adopt toward their heroes, for example, constitutes the outward expression of the force that propels them toward embodying or incarnating or even inventing oft ill-defined heroic qualities themselves. The capacity for imitation surfaces in more abstract guise in the human tendency to act as if, to identify with another, to become another in fantasy, which means to ritually identify with or unconsciously adopt the story of another. This means the ability to adopt someone else's goal as if it were yours. The capacity to act as if expresses itself in admiration, ranging in intensity from the simple respect accorded a competent other to abject worship, and, even more abstractly, in ideological possession. No independent instinct necessarily needs to be postulated to account for this mimetic ability, although one may well exist. All that may be necessary is the capacity to observe that another has obtained a goal that is also valued by the observer. That observation provides the necessary motivation and the skill to duplicate the procedures observed to lead to such fulfillment. Mimetic propensity, expressed in imitative action, provides for tremendous expansion of behavioral competence, allows the ability of each to become the capability of all. Precise duplicative facility, however, still retains pronounced limitations. Specific behaviors retain their adaptive significance only within particular restricted environments, only within bounded frames of reference. If environmental contingencies shift, for whatever reason, the utility of strategies designed for the original circumstance and transmitted through imitation may become dramatically restricted or even reversed. The capacity for abstraction of imitation, which is, in the initial stages, capability for dramatic play, overcomes the specific restrictions of exact imitation, elaborating reproduction of particular acts, removing the behavior to be copied from its initial specific context, establishing its first-level declarative representation and generalization. Play allows for the permanent extension of competence and confidence through pretense, which means through metaphoric and symbolic action, which is semantic use of episodic representation, and for natural expansion of behavioral range from safe, predictable, self-defined contexts out toward the unknown world of experience. Play creates a world in rule-governed fantasy, in episodic or imagistic representation, in which behavior can be rehearsed and mastered prior to its expression in the real world with real-world consequences. Play is another form of as-if behavior that allows for experimentation with fictional narrative, pretended descriptions of the current and desired future states of the world with plans of action appended designed to change the former into the latter. To play means to set or to fictionally transform fictional goals. Such fictional goals give valence to phenomena that would in other contexts remain meaningless. Valence that is informative without being serious. Play allows us to experiment with means and ends themselves without subjecting ourselves to the actual consequences of real behavior and to benefit emotionally in the process. The goals of play are not real. The incentive rewards, however, that accompany movement to a pretended goal, these are real, although bounded, like game-induced anxieties. The bounded reality of such affect accounts, at least in part, for the intrinsic interest that motivates and accompanies play, or immersion in any dramatic activity. Play transcends imitation in that it is less context-bound. It allows for the abstraction of essential principles from specific, admirable instances of behavior. Play allows for the initial establishment of a more general model of what constitutes allowable or ideal behavior. Elaboration of dramatic play into formal drama likewise ritualizes play, abstracting its key elements one level more and further distills the vitally interesting aspects of behavior, which are representative, by no mere chance, of that active exploratory and communicative pattern upon which all adaptation is necessarily predicated. Theatrical ritual dramatically represents the individual and social consequences of stylized, distilled behavioral patterns based in their expression upon different assumptions of value and expectations of outcome. Formal drama clothes potent ideas in personality, exploring different paths of directed or motivated action, playing out conflict cathartically, offering ritual models for emulation or rejection. Dramatic personae embody the behavioral wisdom of history. In an analogous fashion, in a less abstract, less ritualized manner, the ongoing behavior of parents dramatizes cumulative mimetic history for children. Emergence of narrative, which contains much more information than it explicitly presents, further disembodies the knowledge extant latently in behavioral pattern. Narrative presents semantic representation of play or drama, offers essentially abstracted episodic representations of social interaction and individual endeavor, and allows behavioral patterns contained entirely in linguistic representation to incarnate themselves in dramatic form on the private stage of individual imagination. Much of the information derived from a story is actually already contained in episodic memory. In a sense, it could be said that the words of the story merely act as a retrieval cue for information already in the nestic system of the listener, although perhaps not yet transformed into a form capable either of explicit semantic communication or alteration of procedure. It is for this reason that Shakespeare might be viewed as a precursor to Freud. Think of Hamlet. Shakespeare knew what Freud later discovered, but he knew it more implicitly, more imagistically, more procedurally. This is not to say that Shakespeare was any less brilliant, just that his level of abstraction was different. Ideas, after all, come from somewhere. They do not arise spontaneously from the void. Every complex psychological theory has a lengthy period of historical development, development that might not be evidently linked to the final emergence of the theory. Interpretation of the reason for dramatic consequences portrayed in narrative, generally left to the imagination of the audience, constitutes analysis of the moral of the story. Transmission of that moral, that rule for behavior or representation, is the purpose of narrative. Just as fascination, involuntary seizure of interest, is its biologically predetermined means. With development of the story, mere description of critically important and therefore compelling behavioral representational patterns becomes able to promote active imitation. At this point, the semantic system, activating images in episodic memory, sets the stage for the alteration of procedure itself. This means establishment of a feedback loop wherein information can cycle up and down levels of consciousness with the social environment as necessary intermediary, transforming itself and expanding as it moves. Development of narrative means verbal abstraction, of knowledge disembodied in episodic memory and embodied in behavior. It means capability to disseminate such knowledge widely and rapidly throughout a communicating population with minimal expenditure of time and energy. Finally, it means intact preservation of such knowledge simply and accurately for generations to come. Narrative description of archetypal behavioral patterns and representational schemas, myth, appears as an essential precondition for social construction and subsequent regulation of complexly civilized individual presumption, action, and desire. It is only after behavioral, procedural wisdom has become represented in episodic memory and portrayed in drama and narrative that it becomes accessible to conscious verbal formulation and potential modification in abstraction. Procedural knowledge is not representational in its basic form. Knowing how information generated in the course of exploratory activity can nonetheless be transferred from individual to individual in the social community through means of imitation. Piaget points out, for example, that children first act upon objects and determine object properties in accordance with these actions, and then almost immediately imitate themselves, turning their own initial spontaneous actions into something to be represented and ritualized. The same process occurs in interpersonal interaction, where the other person's action rapidly becomes something to be imitated and ritualized, and then abstracted and codified further. A shared right, where each person's behavior is modified by that of the other, can therefore emerge in the absence of consciousness of the structure of the right. However, once the social ritual is established, its structure can rapidly become described and codified, presuming sufficient cognitive ability and level of maturation. This process can in fact be observed during the spontaneous construction and then codification of children's games. It is the organization of such games and their elaboration through repeated communication that constitutes the basis for the construction of culture itself. Behavior is imitated, then abstracted into play, formalized into drama and story, crystallized into myth, and codified into religion, and only then criticized in philosophy and provided post hoc with rational underpinnings. Explicit philosophical statements regarding the grounds for and nature of ethical behavior, stated in a verbally comprehensible manner, were not established through rational endeavor. Their framing as such is clearly a secondary endeavor, as Nietzsche recognized. What the scholars called a rational foundation for morality and tried to supply was, seen in the right light, merely a scholarly expression of the common faith in the prevalent morality, a new means of expression for this faith. Explicit moral philosophy arises from the mythos of culture, grounded in procedure, rendered progressively more abstract and episodic through ritual action and observation of that action. The process of increasing abstraction has allowed the knowing what system to generate a representation in imagination of the implicit predicates of behavior governed by the knowing how system. Generation of such information was necessary to simultaneously ensure accurate prediction of the behavior of others and of the self, and to program predictable social behavior through exchange of abstracted moral, procedural information. Nietzsche states further that individual philosophical concepts are not anything capricious or autonomously evolving, but grow up in connection and relationship with each other. That however suddenly and arbitrarily they seem to appear in the history of thought, they nevertheless belong just as much to a system as all the members of the fauna of a continent, is betrayed in the end also by the fact that the most diverse philosophers, keep filling in a definite, fundamental scheme of possible philosophies. Under an invisible spell, they always revolve once more in the same orbit. However independent of each other they may feel themselves with their critical or systematic wills, something within them leads them, something impels them in a definite order, one after the other. To wit, the innate systematic structure and relationship of their concepts. Their thinking is, in fact, far less a discovery than a recognition, a remembering, a return and a homecoming to a remote, primordial, and inclusive household of the soul, out of which those concepts grew originally. Philosophizing is to this extent a kind of atavism of the highest order. The knowing what system, declarative, episodic, and semantic, has developed a description of knowing how activity, procedure, through a complex, lengthy process of abstraction. Action and imitation of action developmentally predate explicit description or discovery of the rules governing action. Adaptation, through play and drama, preceded development of linguistic thought and provided the ground from which it emerged. Each developmental stage, action, imitation, play, ritual, drama, narrative, myth, religion, philosophy, rationality, offers an increasingly abstracted, generalized, and detailed representation of the behavioral wisdom embedded in and established during the previous stage. The introduction of semantic representation to the human realm of behavior allowed for continuance and ever-increasing extension of the cognitive process originating in action, imitation, play, and drama. Language turned drama into mythic narrative, narrative into formal religion, and religion into critical philosophy, providing for exponential expansion of adaptive ability. Consider Nietzsche's words once again. Gradually it has become clear to me what every great philosophy so far has been, namely, the personal confession of its author and a kind of involuntary and unconscious memoir. Also, that the moral or immoral intentions in every philosophy constituted the real germ of life from which the whole plant had grown. The procedural system provides, constitutes, memory for behavior. Such memory includes imitative representation of behaviors generated spontaneously in the course of creative individual action, whose precise circumstance of origins have been lost in the mists of history, but which have been integrated into a consistent behavioral pattern over time, integrated into culturally determined character. Integration means active balance of competing subjectively grounded motivational demands within the context of the social environment, means internalization of socially regulated behavioral expression of subjective desire. Such internalization constitutes construction of a value dominance hierarchy, means determination of the relative contextual propriety, morality, of imitated or otherwise incorporated patterns of action. Such construction inevitably precedes episodic or semantic representation of the basis of the construction, although such second-order representation, once established, becomes capable, indirectly, of modifying procedure itself, as what is imagined can then be acted out. This is the loop that feeds the development of explicit consciousness itself. Procedure is established, then represented, then altered in abstraction, then practiced. The procedure changes as a consequence of the abstracted and practiced modification. This change in turn produces an alteration in its representation, and so on, from individual to individual, down the chain of generations. This process can occur externally as a consequence of social interaction, or internally as a consequence of word and image-mediated abstract exploratory activity, thought. This interactive loop and its putative relationship to underlying cognitive memory structures are represented schematically in Figure 13.